Howdy, folks, and welcome back again here to Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam, and joining me is mi amigo here, as always, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody?
Hope everybody had a wonderful weekend. Hope they had a wonderful Valentine's Day. I know I did. It was just, look, I don't really buy into the whole Valentine's Day thing. I'm not a big fan of only, you know, once a year you're going to treat your lady nice or your lady going to treat you, man. It's a joke made to sell stuff. I get that, but man, I ate a lot. I mean, my Valentine's Day consisted of going to a good lunch with my, and then going to a dinner. And man, I don't know, but did y'all have a pretty good dinner over here, homie?
Yeah, that's how we did. We stayed home. We bought some steaks and got some lobster tails, and we grilled out an asparagus. And,
whoa!
Yeah, we just made a little feast.
Nice.
And then me and we watched some crazy movie with the kids.
That was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was okay.
Hope everybody had a very, very good Valentine's. And if you don't have a Valentine's, you're probably better off because you save some money. That's probably what I'm saying. Maybe not be such a bad thing to be single. That's pretty much what I'm putting out there, folks. Anyhow, we're going to jump right into it. We've got a really, really fun show today planned. We got some really interesting stuff. Apparently, everybody loved the interview with Red Pill Junkie. We had a, you know, that was pretty wild. I mean, people were jumping up and down. They seemed to really enjoy it. So, man, I mean, that was
He's
awesome.
A unique character for sure. And you're right. A ton of people wrote in with emails and stuff talking about how much they enjoyed having Miguel on the show. So we really appreciate that. Well, let's jump into the news
let's
here.
Let's get this going. Yeah, let's
Did
do this.
Did you see this, Cam? This comes to us from The Guardian. Did you see this? That scientists have created contact lenses that magnify when you blink your eyes.
I saw a little something about that while I was kind of scrolling around through the intraweb, but I didn't really read anything about it. But I don't even know how you would do this. You know, I mean, I can't even fathom this.
Man, is technology not incredible? I mean, it really is getting super sci-fi around here. It says that the contact lens magnifies objects with the wink of an eye has just been created by scientists to help people with impaired vision. I don't know why you have to be impaired. Wouldn't it be cool just to have it normally? I mean,
you're right.
Zoom in. The lens contains an extremely thin telescope that is switched on when the wearer winks their right eye and returns to normal when they wink their left eye.
I want that now myself.
Right? That is incredible. You could build in range finders and everything.
That's what I want.
When you're bow hunting or whatever, you know, and you know your yardage.
What if you could use it in sports? Like,
why not?
Quarterbacks use it or something, you know what I mean? Like, they're blinking. I mean, I don't have any idea, but mine would be like zooming in and out and in and out, in and out, blinking. Yeah, it would be a mistake, but I don't know. That might be pretty cool.
Pretty cool, right? Now, it says the contact lens magnifies objects by 2.8 times, making road signs, facial features, and other objects large enough for people with AMD to recognize it with their peripheral vision. Now, AMD, which is age-related macular degeneration, which leaves a lot of people blind in the center of their eye only.
I got you.
And that's what this is going to be used. Now, this device was funded by DARPA.
Uh-oh.
You know?
Yep, I got you.
As a means of giving soldiers a form of bionic vision.
There you go.
It says they were really interested in supervision, but the reality is more tame than that. Now, this was from a Dr. Tremblay at the American Association for Advancement of Science. So far, only 5 people have tested the latest version of this. The device is larger and slightly thicker than a normal contact lens. It allows the wearer to see normally by correcting for short or long sight. But around the central region is a thin ring-shaped reflective telescope, which expands the perceived size of objects, kind of like wearing very weak binoculars. The snap that between the magnified vision, the wearer just dons a pair of liquid crystal glasses, and by winking, they can switch the glasses electronically to polarize light in different planes. The contact lens is designed so that one type of polarized light goes through the normal central part of the lens, while the other goes through the magnifying region. Anyways, pretty awesome stuff. I mean, you can see how, you know, I can foresee a day where it doesn't just help people who are going blind or have problems with vision, but it really will be for, like, super soldiers.
Have you ever put contacts in your eyes?
No, I never have.
I never have either. I don't know what kind of irritation that would be as far as, I mean, I'm assuming, you know, you're really going to feel like a thickness, but I've never, you know, they said it's a little bit thicker. I wonder what that would do. You know, I mean, I'm sure you can get used to it. I mean, you can get used to a lot of things, but I've never done it. I just wonder what they would, if you've never had contacts and you started out with a thicker contact, then you probably would never know the difference once you got used to that.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure you're right. And besides, even if it was a little bit uncomfortable, like you're saying, if it makes a difference between not being able to see and then being able to see, I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, and there's all types of things you could use. I mean, imagine lifeguards or something. Instead of having to look through binoculars all the time, I mean, you just put these contact lenses in when you go to work, and, man, you can see really far, right?
I never thought of that. That sounds pretty awesome.
All right. Well, moving on. Did you see this? This comes from space.com, and it's an article posted by Joseph Castro, and it's about what it would be like to live on the moon. Now, we've talked about this.
Yes, we have.
Several times on the show about maybe secret bases being up on the moon or remnants of an ancient civilization up on the moon and things like that. But what would it really, we never really contemplate what it would really be like to actually live on the moon. And it's not as easy as it first seems. I mean, it's not just a matter of building a structure. I mean, they're talking about that on the moon, it's their days even, okay? Much like, in, you know, when you go up north, like in Alaska and stuff, it has different times of the year. It'll be dark, nonstop dark for a couple days or weeks. Same thing happens on the moon. If you were in the middle or whatever, the lunar days stretch for about 14 Earth days is one lunar day, okay?
Oh, really?
And it says the temperatures vary from being in the shade or the sunlight. Now, we've talked about that. Now, it says that in the sun, it can be 250 degrees Fahrenheit or 123 degrees Celsius. And it says, but then again, on the opposite end of the spectrum at nighttime, it can get as cold as minus 387 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 233. Yeah, this is
real. I've heard of that a lot, but man, is that really real?
Minus 233 degrees Celsius in the shade.
So those suits, while they were up there in these videos on the moon, that really protected them from all that.
I guess so.
Man, I don't see how that's possible. You know what I mean? Like, when you're talking about like in the shade, you get into the shade of like the lander. If you're in the shade of it, does it instantly get that cold? You know what I mean?
Well, I don't know about instantly, but still, I mean, that is really cold. I mean, minus 387 degrees Fahrenheit.
I don't know how that suit would keep anything. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about ridiculous colds. I mean, what would it do to... Man, I don't know about that. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just, you know what I mean? That starts making me question a lot of things. Every time I hear those numbers, I'm just like, really?
Well, they said if we were going to build a structure on the moon to live, the best place to do it would probably be...
Here, on Earth.
At the lunar poles. Because he says, when just like we were talking about, if you're on the lunar poles, instead of it being different contrast between middle of the day or middle of the night... It would kind of always be like dusk, and it would be, it says that it would be a much more manageable temperature, like 0 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit.
I got you. Yeah, that makes more sense. Yeah.
So maybe that's where the lunar thing landed. I don't know exactly where at. I don't think it landed on the poles though, but you know, it's just freezing temperatures. And so that's much more manageable, but you know, then the article goes on to talk about, There's seismic activity on the moon. There's earthquakes. There's a whole bunch of different things. There's crevices and that would make the Grand Canyon look small.
You think we'll ever inhabit it?
Man, I think so. I think that someday somebody is going to be able to build an outpost, and much like, Antarctica and stuff, there was an outpost only, and then after a while, more people started going, more people. And I think that it would be one day. A jet setter's travel to place. You know, somebody would go on vacation. You could go to the moon.
It makes me think of Total Recall.
I think it'll happen. I mean, maybe not real soon, but I think it could happen.
I hope so.
And then, you know, who knows? Maybe your great-great-great-grandchildren will get married on the moon or something. You know what I mean?
I hope so. That'd be cool. That would be cool to have it up there like that.
Here's the thing. If they built like a big auditorium where you could play sports or something, I mean, talk about fun. Imagine playing a basketball game with almost zero gravity.
You couldn't do that.
Why couldn't you?
You'd have to wear all your suits. How would you dribble?
No. Like in the space station. Like if they built a space station there, you might not need the suit. They could have oxygen in there.
Were you just bouncing around in there?
Yeah, because think about it. Even if you had a room like this, the studio, on the moon and it had oxygen and stuff, there's still less gravity than there is on Earth.
I don't think you could even
bounce a ball. It's not zero gravity, but do what?
It'd be horrible. How would you even control the ball and play the game and bounce around? Although, you know what I'd like to see?
What's that?
Like the UFC in weightlessness, where you're like pushing off the walls and fighting, where it looks like you're like in the Matrix. You're flying through the air with like flying sidekicks, Joey Diaz style.
Would you be going so slow? I mean, it would be easy to defend.
I don't know. It'd still be fun to watch.
I bet golf. I mean, I bet you could really drive a golf ball.
Baseball, golf.
You could hit one like a mile.
Archery.
Oh, yeah, I never thought of that, right?
That would be awesome.
What if you just shoot it straight up? Like, but would it never come back?
Never comes back.
Man, that would be awesome.
How far could you shoot, like, outdoor? Like, could you imagine a field range? You're trying to shoot, I don't know, like 500 yards with it. That would be awesome.
That would be awesome.
Oh, I'm down. Well, here, speaking of awesome, this popped up off of Open Minds, and it kind of fit in with last week's show, and this is one of those things that kind of hung up on me here, but it happened in Florida. And it kind of goes back into what we talked with Red Pill about. Florida witnesses describe a hovering boomerang-shaped UFO.
See, here we are again with the triangle or boomerang
strange shapes, right?
Mm-hmm.
It says a Florida witness at Palm Harbor reported watching a hovering boomerang-shaped UFO with, yet again, three bright white lights.
Okay.
We always say the three lights are
it's always the three,
too.
Yeah.
And because I know that you love to write this down and keep up with this information, it's case number 63122.
Okay, thank you very much. Say that one more time. What was the number?
63122.
It's
the MUFON
case. Thank you. Thank you.
I know you love it. The witness goes on to say that he and his wife, which was the passenger, were driving northbound along East Lake Road and approaching a stoplight when they first saw the object. Now, this just happened February 5th. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It says, I looked up at approximately 70 degrees. Okay. And noticed a series of three bright white lights. And he stated that there were no red aircraft lights. Now, he says that as the witness claims, he says the vehicle moved toward the object. Trees obstructed their view, but another 40 yards later, they saw the object again. It says the object reappeared approximately at the same location where it was first sighted, indicating it had not moved from the point where it was first sighted, of course, 10 seconds before. So they believe it was kind of sitting there.
Right.
Said it once again seemed to be hovering in a stationary position in the sky just under 500 feet and less than 500 feet from the witness. The witness states that there were no flashing or colored lights. There was no fuselage, only a boomerang-shaped wing with a white light at the apex and one on each wing tip. Now, right. We've heard that numerous times, different reports and things that you read. This is kind of what comes up.
Well, and you wouldn't be accidentally mistaking it for an airplane if it's 500 feet away.
Yes.
I mean, you have a good, that's pretty close.
You're exactly right. It was one of those things you didn't just, oh, yeah.
If it was a drone, then you would hear the engines.
Yes.
You would hear
yes.
the propellers or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah, making racket. You're exactly right. They go on to say, I probably could have subtended the object with my extended hand. He said, this is not a familiar flight path. It was dark except for street lights and a full moon, which did not interfere with the sighting. However, it may have served to backlight the object and make the silhouette of the wing easy to see. The lights were large in proportion to the actual wing they appeared affixed to, making the proportions different than a passing aircraft. And it was all over in about 10 seconds or less, but he said it was really cool. Now, of course, like we've gone on to say that now, there's different ratings, but Florida is currently at a UFO alert level 5. Okay, now alert level 5 is a low rating. That states with like a 2.0 or lower, and they're rated at an alert level 5. And it's basically a number of sightings. So basically, Florida received a total number of sightings in January of 37 UFO reports. And this has been, like I said, Pinellas County in Palm Harbor, a little less, they say, than 60,000 people. So it's not like a tiny little town out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, you're talking about this sighting was over a fairly large city.
Yeah.
And is a UFO? Or, I mean, a UFO. It was a boomerang. So, I mean, it's goes back into the shapes that we talked about. They go from, like, you know, missiles to discs to, you know, like cigars,
eggs,
all these. And now it seems to be more of a V or the wing or the. So I don't really know, man. It's just it's strange to me that the shapes keep changing.
It does seem odd that they keep changing. It's like with our technology as it's progressing, the shapes of these UFOs are changing.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I don't know. Did you see this? This comes from the BBC News. And speaking about aliens. This is an article about scientists in the U.S. are urged to seek contact with the aliens.
Oh, so like the SETI and stuff may be getting a little boost of money, hopefully.
That's right. They said that scientists at a U.S. conference recently said it's time to try to actively contact intelligent life on other worlds. Now, researchers involved in the search for extraterrestrial life are considering what the message from Earth should even be. The call was made for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute at a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in San Jose. But others argued that making our presence known might be dangerous. Now, Stephen Hawking is one of those guys that says, look, you might not want to be broadcasting that we're here, because I don't know what you know about history, but it tells you that first contacts between industrial civilizations and indigenous peoples historically has not gone well on this planet.
I could not agree with Stephen anymore. I don't believe that we should be broadcasting our presence at all. It's one thing to look, right? It's a whole other thing to start trying to announce to everybody that you're here.
I agree. Now, it says researchers, researchers at SETI have been listening for signals from outer space for more than 30 years. Now, remember, Carl Sagan was a big proponent of this SETI, and he was a backer of it and was there when it was originally starting. And they use these radar telescopes. It looks like giant satellite dishes.
Like the movie Contact. Man,
yeah.
I love it.
Exactly. And so far, there has not been any sign of ET. Now, the organization's director, Dr. Seth Shostak, you know what he looks like, mm-hmm. told attendees that some of us at the Institute are interested in active SETI, not just listening, but broadcasting something to some nearby stars, because maybe there's some chance that if you wake somebody up, you might get a response. Now, he says a lot of people are against active SETI because they say it is dangerous. It is like shouting in the jungle. You don't know what is out there. You better not do it. But if you incite the aliens to obliterate the planet, you would not want that on your tombstone, right?
Right.
Well, and then he brings up a good point. You know, he says that he doesn't think any reason why aliens would have any incentive in doing that. He doesn't believe that they're going to hear it and travel interstellarly and come over here and kill us. But how would you know that? That's a completely wild claim, because how would you know what they would do? You have no idea.
Pure
and much like we always talk about, if they are way advanced and we're nothing compared to them, it's just like when you're sitting there, like Red Pill was talking about. If you're sitting there eating a sandwich and you see an ant, do you start trying to talk to the ant? Why would you try to talk to the ant? Do you even feel bad if you just smash that ant while you're eating your sandwich? No. What if they are looking for gold? Much like Zachariah Sitchin talks about, and they come to Earth to mine gold to redistribute in their atmosphere. What if they don't know we exist, and all of a sudden they hear us and our message is like, "What is this?" And they could be looking for Blarcy, and they find us. And I mean, it would be super easy to eradicate us, right?
What I instantly think about all the time when they start talking about sending out this stuff is, anytime you do any kind of hunts for predators, when you're hunting for like coyotes especially.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right. You do that call, and you're calling, and they're coming to that sound. And you're the point of origin for that sound. It's kind of unnerving the first few times you ever do it when you're a young person, or even if you're an older person, you've never done it, and you have the box or the mouth call, and you're calling, and you – because I've had them come right up on us before you ever see them, and you may not ever get a shot off. You can just call just to watch if you want to. But here they come. Boom. And they're coming with evil intent of they're going to fill their belly.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost the way this feels, is you start broadcasting this out there. You don't know what is going to come.
And most of the time, it's nighttime when you're doing this, so it's dark.
Yep.
It's not like you're in a city street and you can back up to a wall. I mean, when you're broadcasting that call out, they can come from 360. You. That's right.
And it's a predator. So you don't know what you're going to get. I mean, that's just, we would love to think it's going to be, warm and fuzzy. You know,
it could be a cougar.
Well, you never know. I mean, you never know of things that come in there. I've had hogs come in. Mm-hmm. I mean, things come in with bad intentions, and that's the way it feels now. I mean, anytime you start calling, that's the idea. You want to let something know you're there, but you don't really always know what you're getting. So that's kind of the way this feels. And I'm more of a fan of listening and learning and trying to watch and figure out than broadcasting it like that. I don't think we need to be trying to reach out and get a hold of folks.
I agree with you.
Not a big fan of that. I'll tell you something else. I'm not a big fan of, and we've been talking about this, and we're going to have Randall Carlson's going to come on and discuss the cataclysms and catastrophes and things, but I'm not a big fan of people wanting to mess around with that kind of stuff. And this actually comes from the NPR. They're actually weighing the pros and cons of what they say messing with Earth's thermostat. Now, in 1991, in the Philippines, Mount Pinatubo actually erupted.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
They were over 20 million, or right at almost 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide was spewed up into the air from one eruption. And they already know that worldwide temperatures at that point dropped a half a degree on average. All right. Now, that's not including, we're not talking about a meteor strike. We're talking about one volcanic
eruption. A volcano.
Eruption. All right.
Yes. These happen all the time.
Exactly. Well, what they're getting to now is that this past Tuesday or so, all right, that there was a scientific panel convened at the National Research Council to assess what they call climate geoengineering, deliberate attempts to alter the global climate.
Now, how do they do this?
Well, we're going to get into this. Geoengineering is what they say has been seen as a potential last-ditch effort to stave off the worst effects of climate change, okay?
Uh-huh.
And they say that it's given the agreements that to reduce greenhouse gas emissions have been, nobody really cares. And they've been talking about all this, the carbon dioxide and everything. And they say, basically, this is what it comes down to. The basic idea is simple. You either suck carbon dioxide from the atmosphere or reflect incoming sunlight away from the Earth. Now, where does that sound like a good idea?
Well, that's going to cool the planet, right?
Yeah.
You know what I think of? I think of, When I hear that, I think of the giant vacuum cleaner on the movie Spaceballs, how that's sucking out the air.
Yeah, right.
That's what I picture. So we need a gigantic Eureka, or I'm sorry, a Dyson.
Dyson.
Yeah. A Dyson vacuum cleaner to suck out the carbon dioxide.
Well, yeah, pretty much that's what they're talking about. Well, now, the committee actually found more conventional approaches, they say, to removing carbon dioxide, such as reforestation. Low risk and well understood, they say, and costly, but it's slow. That's the problem. They want to have something, you know, boom. Now, they're taking steps to reflect more sunlight back into space, they say, could work to cool the planet quickly, as much as volcanic eruptions, like we talked about. And it wouldn't take too much money, they say, and technological innovations, they say, would help, because you could, I guess they're talking about setting up massive amounts of solar panels would also help to reflect some of the sun. But they go on to say that the risks could be huge, aside from the threat of damage to the Earth's ozone layer and unknown consequences for global precipitation patterns, there could be political fallout and social upheaval. So the committee recommended against attempting this, but said research was needed to better understand it. All right. Now, some of the experts go on to say that I think we have to know that the risks are and what the risks are and that what the benefits are, so that we can make informed decisions in the future. Now, this was Alan Robach, and he's, of course, a climate scientist from Rutgers. He said, would it be more dangerous to do it or not to do it? And, I mean, and it goes on, folks. They argue back and forth, and the article's great to give you a very balanced idea, but basically it comes down to this. Do you really want to mess with this? Is it, I mean, we've discussed it, and after you listen to the Atlantis, whenever in the coming ice age of what Frank talked about, you do a little research, you look around and hear, you realize, yes, human beings play a big part in, I say a big part, they play a part of global warming, but there's a lot more. There's a lot more to the global warming than just human beings.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, they know from ice core samples that there were warmer than now periods, even in medieval times.
Yes.
Where
yes.
It was warmer than it is now. Now, this is before the Industrial Revolution. There was not any carbon dioxide put there by humans.
Yes.
You know, and so this does happen. Now, there's no denying, though, that we are having an effect.
Yes.
There's nobody that, I think, denies that. But these things happen even regardless if people are here. And just like you're saying, what if 12 super volcanoes erupted right now? I mean, it would bring on an ice age.
It could. I mean, you're talking about it drop it a couple. If one erupted that much, and it dropped it by half a degree. Well, if you had that many of them, then you're talking about dropping it by, you know, what, 3-4 degrees total.
And that's all it would take.
That could be all it took. That's what I think is, I don't think they know enough. And, of course, who am I? I don't know anything. I'm just going off of, you know, things that I've read. I don't know a thing, at all. But I just don't feel like we know enough to make it worth our while to start tinkering with things.
Well, I mean, can they really build enough solar panels to reflect enough light off to cool the planet? I mean, look, the planet already is 3/4 water. That's what reflects most of the sunlight.
Yes.
And then you got the ice caps on the poles. Those reflect a lot of sunlight.
Well, it goes back into what you talked about when they were talking about building tornado walls.
Yeah.
So undoubtedly they know. I mean, they know what they can and can't do. They don't say how much it is or where they would build it. And you're talking about, you take a place like, let's say that's West Texas or Nevada, you're talking about out in the big of the deserts. If you put miles and miles, like they have the wind gens in West Texas, if you put miles and miles of giant solar panels up, not only would it give a lot of energy, which is what we need, but we don't think about it. What if it reflected just enough sunlight to start cooling the Earth's temperature? And it's like we said, there's a fine line, and maybe we cross it. Maybe we're doing well, but we cross it. You know what I mean? And then once we cross it, you can never come back. And then you look like, well, we thought we were doing good. It's one of those things we need to study. I agree with what they're saying. I agree with Alan. You need to study this. But I don't know that we need to start tinkering. It's always kind of the idea of cloud seeding, where they want to seed it for rain and all that stuff. It always sounded great. And then people would seed them lots of times and have flash floods. So you kind of got to, there's a point you got to weigh it out and really watch it. So but that's just something. So I just saw it. I'm like, you know what? That's funny. We were just talking, you and I, we talk about this weekly, about these cataclysms and stuff. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, pretty interesting. Well, stick with us, folks. We're going to take a break, and when we get back from the break, we're going to discuss the unusual happenings of a Mr. Don Decker known as the Stroudsburg Rain Man. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. The year was 1983,
In the laid-back borough of Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, 21-year-old Don Decker had just been sent to serve a sentence of a full year in prison for receiving stolen property. He had been quietly serving his time when Don received news of his grandfather's death in February of that year. Given a weekend furlough, Don went back home to attend his grandfather's funeral. When Don had approached the casket, a tsunami of emotions ran through his head. Unbeknownst to many, his grandfather had abused him as a child. Years of repressed anger washed over his blank stare as he stood in front of his grandfather. Don left the funeral home soon after. It wasn't until that night that Don's story takes a surprising turn into the unexplained. Don Decker's mother didn't want anything to do with her son. She was a world-class loser. She barred him from stepping foot into her home, thus forcing Don to live with some friends of the family. Bob and Janine Kiefer knew Don since he was a little boy and had no qualms about taking in a convicted man into their home. Don had always been a good kid. He just had gotten mixed up with the wrong crowd.
I originally met Don. My wife and his mother worked together. I got a call from him one day telling me that his grandfather had passed away, but his mom wouldn't allow him to come home. I told him it didn't matter. He could stay with us however long he wanted to. He realized he made a mistake. He was hanging out with the wrong people, but wanted to straighten his life out. I wanted to try to help him.
That night at the Kiefer's, an unsettling feeling chilled its way up Don's spine while sitting in the living room while watching television. In Don's head, a firestorm of emotions brewed in what seemed like a sudden panic attack. Within moments, water began dripping from this room's ceiling, creeping out Don and the Kiefer's alike.
We see water running down the wall. We thought there had to be some kind of leak, but there's no water in that end of the house. There's no water lines in any place but the kitchen and the bathroom, which were in the back of the house. I just didn't know where it was coming from.
Bob knew that there were no water pipes that run up or down, side to side on that side of their home. He decided to call his landlord so that he could come take a look. Now, Ron H. Van arrived shortly after Bob's phone call. Now, Ron knew the layout of the house and was dumbfounded when he, too, witnessed the water coming from the ceiling.
We couldn't figure out where in the world all this water was coming from.
Then the family noticed something else. Water seemed to be coming out from the walls and the floor. Don remembers feeling an extreme coldness around him that night. Soon after, he would fall into a trance-like state, quietly staring straight into nothingness. Now scared, Ron decided to call the police. He figured they could assist them or solve the mystery of the phantom water. When patrolmen John Bojan and Richard Wolbest arrived at the house, they walked into the living room to observe water dripping from the walls, ceiling, and floor. As they began to inspect the room, the patrolmen see water drops beginning to travel horizontally. That means from wall to wall. They froze in a state of sheer wonder and fear. Just then, to add to their chill, they both observed water droplets hover in mid-air and travel out of the room. Within minutes of being at the premises, the patrolmen were soaked through and through from head to toe. Meanwhile, Don's trance looked like it hadn't abated. In fact, he looked to be in too bad of shape that Officer Richard Walbert suggested they leave the premises and go wait at the local pizzeria until they figured out what was happening inside the house. Ron decided to stay with the officers and his house to help them figure out the strange situation before them. As soon as Don and the Kiefer's left the house, the mysterious rain stopped entirely. Walls, floors, and ceiling began drying up while the coldness inside the house had vaporized. Ron began to think that one of the three were responsible for the water. Now, Pan Scrifano said, "You looked at Donnie, and you could tell he was in a trance. He would look at you, but not knowing you were there. I said to Jenny, 'He's got to be possessed. We're sitting there.' A couple of seconds later, there's water all over the pizzeria, too. I've never seen anything like that happen. I went in the cash register. I had a crucifix in there, and I took it out and put it on him. Within a minute, I had put it on him and touched his skin. He got burned. There's no way that anybody could have played a joke like that. This was very real. Donnie was doing it himself. He was doing it without even realizing he was doing it. Now, Pam Scrofano owned the pizza shop and had witnessed the strange rain when she visited the Kiefers earlier that day. She was convinced that Donnie had become possessed by something evil. At that moment, Don snapped out of his trance and could remember everything that had transpired since he was at the house watching television. Don knew that he somehow was to blame for the mysterious rainfall. Things only started as soon as he left the funeral home earlier that day. That made me more sure that I had something to do with it, because it was following me, and it didn't start raining in the house until I got there. They were living there, and nothing ever happened. That's when I started to realize that it was me. Now, all three of them soon left the pizzeria, and to no one's surprise, the rain stopped inside the pizzeria as soon as Don left. They were certain Don was the culprit. They decided to go back home. As soon as he arrived at the house, Don walked in and the waterworks began. This time, pots and pans in the kitchen began vibrating and rattling off the countertops whenever Don approached. Tired of what was going on, Ron's wife accused Donnie of perpetrating a hoax. With fingers pointing at him, Don begins to feel concerned and pressured. Things take a dramatic turn for the worse when in front of many, Don appears to levitate inches from the ground and then is thrown violently across the room. It had been well over 24 hours at this point when the patrolman returned, this time with the chief of police in tow. As soon as the police chief walked into the house, he was bombarded with water drops, some traveling horizontally like before. Immediately, his uniform became saturated with water from the mysterious mist cloud that now hovered inside the room. The police chief was unnerved by what he was seeing and decided to order his men out. He told them that this was a plumbing issue and not to file the standard police report. The three of them quickly left afterwards, leaving the rest to figure out the phenomenon. Afterwards, things settled down the best they could. The very next day, the officer had returned. Ignoring the straight orders of the police chief, they had also brought along some other partners of the precinct. Bill Davies was one of them. "We were standing there. I gave Mr. Decker this gold cross to hold. Next thing he says, 'It's burning my hands.' And there's no explanation for it. When you picked it up, when you grabbed it, it's not hot, but it's hot. And I held on to it." Soon after Bill Davies' observation, Lieutenant John Rundle witnessed yet another levitation by Donnie. All of a sudden, he lifted up off the ground, and he flew across the room with the force as though a bus had hit him. There were three claw marks on the side of his neck, which drew blood. I have no answer for it whatsoever. I just draw a blank, even today. I've been a cop 40 years, and I've never seen anything like this. Never. There's always an explanation when something happens. If you gotta investigate, you come up with something. This is why it happened. For this case, there is no explanation. Now, Ron remained adamant about helping Donnie out. He had observed more and more strange phenomena inside his house and was fully convinced that Donnie had no part in it, at least not willingly. Ron began calling Catholic priests around town, hoping to get an exorcism for Donnie. The Catholic Church does not do them on a whim. There exists strict and meticulous criteria a case must meet before granting the exorcism. Ron and the rest had no time. They contacted a local evangelical preacher who agreed to do the exorcism. As they prayed, Donnie began to convulse violently. He writhed and gritted his teeth while laying on the floor. The preacher continued with the ritual. Hours later, things seemed to have stopped. The rain vanished and the coldness left. Don began to instantly feel better, as if whatever had taken a hold of him had released him from its demonic grip. The next few days, things appeared to fall back into normalcy. Don's furlough came to an end and he was admitted back into prison. While in his cell, Don thought about his ordeal during the last few days and wondered if he might be able to manifest water on a whim.
He concentrated lightly, and to his surprise, water began seeping from all over his cell. The guards quickly accused Don of throwing water from the sink and threatened disciplinary action. When Don told them that he had the ability to summon water, they scoffed at his face. One of the prison's guards dared Don to make it rain inside the prison warden's office. Don accepted the challenge and began to concentrate on the request. Over at the warden's office, Lieutenant David Keenhold was a temporary warden and had been filling out reports all day. He was unaware of the situation with Don and his unique ability. A few guards knocked on his door to check to see if Don really had the power to manifest water, and much to their horror, they walked in to see Lieutenant with completely drenched shirt. Lieutenant Keenhold hadn't noticed his soaking wet shirt until the men burst into his office. They all sat mystified and unnerved. Lieutenant Keenhold then called for Reverend William Blackburn, a local clergy whom he had befriended. Upon arrival, Reverend Blackburn listened to what had happened to Don just a few days ago and confronted Don and accused him of making it all up. Don's demeanor instantly changed as he closed his eyes in concentration. The room was instantly engulfed in a strong, foul odor. Many management and administration personnel were witness to the events. With all the common happening and the commotion, Don raised his hand and began rubbing his fingers together to produce a thick mist that quickly covered the room. Everyone and everything was completely drenched. The Reverend then proceeded with a ritual in which Don and him prayed for hours. Soon things began to lift inside the cell, causing Don to break down into tears. It was all over. When Reverend William Blackburn had finished, Don had a newfound sense of peace within him. It would be the last time he would be able to manifest rain. Oh man, what a crazy story, right?
That is insane.
I mean, it is, you know, it sounds like science fiction.
It does.
And it's, you know, it's a paranormal story. It's incredible. I mean, this is one of the most bizarre poltergeist cases out there. One of the ones that, you know, I think stands out that most people just never talk about. And what I find fascinating is the correlation between Don's initial emotional outburst and, you know, all the phenomenon that started to happen because of it. I mean, it's almost like, oh, he had so much an emotional feeling and hatred for this grandfather that abused him sexually, I guess.
Yeah.
It doesn't say it was sexual, but it just says abused him. But I'm assuming that's what they think it is. That when the guy was dead, he had such a flood of emotions that it actually started creating this poltergeist activity. And the thing that I liked the best about it was the great number of witnesses. And some of the witnesses were trained police officers, okay? So we're talking two or three police officers saw it. The landlord of the people that owned the house that they were tenants were staying in saw it. The two people that took him in and were letting him stay there, they saw it. People at the jail saw it, at the jail cell, the warden, the people at the pizzeria. I mean, how do you deny when all these witnesses saw it happening? Water not just going from the ceiling down, but coming from the walls, going from the floor, going up, moving horizontally, they said. I mean, I don't know if it was really like raining. That's just the best way they can describe it. But it was like water was coming out of everywhere. I don't know. Now, this is not the first time where pre-adolescent kids with like post-traumatic stress disorder have these sudden outbursts, and it's an outburst of kinetic energy or psychokinetic energy.
Yeah.
And it causes the poltergeist phenomenon. Pots rattling, clocks rattling, things falling. You know, it happens a lot with like adolescent girls.
Yeah, we've discussed that. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yes. It's like their emotions somehow are causing. I think that's what this Don Decker is. Without him knowing it, his emotions were so strong that somehow he started manifesting and making it rain. And that's, I mean, but it's the only thing I can, I mean, I'm grasping at straws because you read the story and it's so fantastical.
I can't wrap my head around
it. What?
Yeah.
But what else could it be?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's no, look, I mean, it's one of those things that people always talk about when they see those poltergeists on television, are those people that are interviewed saying there's poltergeists and they get scratches on their bodies, you know, and they're like, oh, they've scratched themselves, or they're doing, it's like an old parlor trick and stuff. And I don't know. There's a lot of different explanations, but it's, what else? And like you said, when they say it's raining, Is that just what they use? Was it a mist? Was it a fog? They talk about water splashing off their bodies. I mean, there, people talk about it in the stories of water splashing off their chests. I mean, some of the prison guards even talked about water legitimately splashing on their clothes. You're like, it's not like a rain cloud, not like a cloud formed. You know, that's what you want to picture in your mind. It's just like water, I guess. Just
it's like being in a steam room or a sauna. You know what I mean? Where it's like you could just feel the moisture. I don't know. It's pretty crazy. Now, Lon Strickler from Phantoms and Monsters, he even talked about it on one of his articles. And he said that the first time he saw it was on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries back in 1983.
Oh, I used to love that show.
Right? Me too. And he said they did a recreation on Paranormal Witness on the Sci-Fi Channel. And he thinks that most likely this was a form of thought form manifestation resulting in poltergeist activity. He goes on to say that these situations are normally resolved when the oppressed individual is removed from whatever stimulated the activity or is able to control those emotions that are feeding this entity. So I think that's exactly what we described. I mean, I think that's what it is.
Yeah. It almost seems like if that's what this is, then the whole idea of tulpas, that can be just as easily explained too. I mean, if it's thought form that caused all this to happen, then if you put that much also into the thought form of anything that you're terrified of, it's almost like you could manifest that yourself.
I think so. I mean, let's be honest. You can use your thoughts to do a lot of things. It's a cliche. Think positive and good things will happen. But it really is true. You ever sit down and tell yourself, let's try to have a good day. Let's think positive all the day. And then at the end of the day, you're like, you know what? I had a pretty good day.
Exactly. Well, it's also like when you picture yourself doing something over and over and over and over, like you've got something, a contest or a competition of any sort coming up, and you picture that through your mind's eye over of how it's going to play out. And then it's strange because your body does it so much easier.
It's because it's like you've done it before.
Exactly. So is that showing the whole, I guess, the whole spectrum of everything is that right there. I tell you something else, though, too. I don't know that the exorcism of this fella helped him out much.
Oh, yeah.
He returned to jail in 2012.
Oh, did he really?
For arson this time.
Oh, Lord.
Well, he was accused of setting fire to a restaurant in the Poconos. And then back in 2012, he turned himself in to the federal court, actually. And, of course, like it says, you know, it goes into the whole story talking about him. But maybe this was a problem that had happened. Maybe this was something I say that caused problems in his life throughout this whole thing. What his grandfather had done or, you know, he claimed had done to him. And then whatever this had followed him around, whatever. It's, I don't know. I feel bad for the guy, but it's still strange. I mean, even in this article that they talk about him being sent back to jail, was a detective named Richard Wolbert. And he was actually on the case. And he even says here that he still can't explain it. He said it was water traveling and flying around the room horizontally.
Really?
That's what he says. And here's another quote from him. It says, it definitely wasn't a plumbing problem. It was just appearing, flying around the room. He said, I was still wearing glasses at the time, and I was getting struck in the face. So it was really strange.
Well, there's other cases that are similar. Now, we're not going to go into those today, but have you ever heard of the Jackie Hernandez case of San Pedro, California?
No.
Well, this was another case similar to Don's where this watery, wet matter began to seep from the walls and the ceilings of his small duplex that he lived in. And there's another one, the Doris Byther case, which also included instances of water permeating through the walls and give the appearance that the walls were sweating. So this is, I mean, there are other cases.
So it's not a one-off thing.
It doesn't appear that way, that this happens sometimes. I don't know. I don't know what to think about it. We don't do very many poltergeist or paranormal type stories on the show. And every once in a while, I like to throw one in. This is a very interesting one. If you're interested, I'm going to put show notes or links to it in the show notes. But you could just Google the Stroudsburg Rain Man or Don Decker and all this. And there's numerous recaps and accounts of these stories. But anyways, very exciting.
Yes, very.
I enjoyed it very much.
Well, I still don't know, man. I'm still at a loss of this whole deal with the rains and this whole, I don't know. It's crazy. I don't know how I would react.
I don't either.
I mean, I really don't know how I would react to something. Like I said, I think I'm better at reaction to maybe a Bigfoot or maybe something along those lines if something happened like that to me than something like this. I just don't know how I would react. Hey, Kyle, I got some stuff forwarded to me Which is, it's just, you know, it always happens. Every time we do some really interesting interview or something, our listeners, you guys are great. They'll forward me all kinds of stories and different links and everything like that. And they were sending some stuff about MIB stuff that actually went down. Now, this one right here actually comes from MUFON, okay?
Uh-huh.
It took place in Houston, Texas in 81. Now, listen to this story. It says, my mother recently passed away from cancer at a very young age. This is unfortunate because I never asked too many details from her regarding a sighting she had of a radar, that's what he says, in a crop field, and then a confirmation followed with MIB agents. All right. That's pretty strange, right?
Yeah.
Says it come out of nowhere. Says all I remember is that she had come to some sort of dead end in a cornfield while lost on her way back from work going home. He said, I couldn't ask her the exact location anymore because she was obviously deceased. Said, I guess I should also mention that she only came forward with the story while we were talking about UFOs together and that she seemed genuinely frightened, which is what we talked about. People, when they come forward, lots of times they don't mention it, you know, like your grandpa talking about the war or something along those lines. Says it took her around 20 years to tell anyone this story at all, and she got very tense whenever I would bring it up to talk about it again. So my proof to you is that this is a very intimidating and scary experience for her. Now, like he says, she was on her way home when she came across a dead end near a crop field. Before turning around the vehicle, she noticed a pulsating light and rotating radar type of machine that had the grass perfectly cut out from underneath it. And some sort of machine from what she observed at the time. Now, she says to herself something along the lines of, what on earth is that? She then looked up and saw a black SUV that came out of absolutely nowhere. They warned her that she should not be in this area and that she needed to leave. She tried explaining that she was only lost, and they cut her off and gave her very quick and concise directions to get away from the vicinity. These men in black, as she described them, were very pale, were wearing sunglasses, and had black suits on. Now, he says this, again, is all going off memory of what her mom, what is the mom was telling. Said they had no identification whatsoever, which really baffled her. Says if they were government, they didn't identify what agency they were from. And apparently she never asked. She was just kind of freaked out and took off. Then I got another one, little MIB deal. Now, this took place in 2000 in Vancouver, B.C.
Okay.
All right. Now, this actually comes from a fellow named Graham Conaway from the UFO BC. All right.
Uh-huh.
Get a load of this. This is awesome. It says, several days after witnessing two low-flying objects over the area on two separate nights, one of the objects was described as huge, making a rumbling noise, and it had a V-shaped tail with two rows of round and oblong windows and was black, gray, and silver in color. And after receiving a suspicious phone call from someone claiming to be a general from the Canadian Armed Forces, two strange men appeared at the door of the witness's residence. They produced wallets, one black, one brown, containing photo ID that stated they were from the Canadian Air Defense. They asked to come inside. The witness extended his hand, but was ignored. Says moving into the house, they took them through the kitchen area, but they stopped upon seeing, you ready?
I'm ready.
The microwave.
What?
Yeah. After some questioning, the witness lowered a portion of a counter, and they carefully slid through the extra space.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. Said sitting down, they produced a small silver-colored tape recorder and inserted a small disc between a nickel and a quarter in size. On entering the house, one of the men had noticed an unusual walking stick in the hallway, to which he remarked that the head of the stick's carving, painted red, reminded him of primates back home. Now, before I go any further, this is the year 2000 is when this is going down.
Right.
And they were freaked out by a microwave.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
It makes zero sense, right?
That is bizarre.
It makes zero sense. So the two men were olive-skinned and appeared to have slanted eyes. Each wore glasses with thick rims. They wore gray suits with black shirts. One had a white tie, and the other was buttoned up to the neck. The one with the tie had a clip that contained a red stone that flickered. The other had a ruby ring surrounded with diamonds. His watch was square, but without apparent hands, instead being encircled with buttons that periodically illuminated from white to green to mauve. The strap seemed to be molded into the skin and was a solid band. The belt on his pants was of metallic strips with a square buckle. Both had very large feet, estimated to be over 14, oversized 14s, and each carried a briefcase that was heavy and cold. So when sitting down, they never relaxed in their chairs, but retained a stiff back the entire time. Now, not once during the stay in the house did they speak to each other. The witness's two cats were extremely agitated the whole time during the visitor's stay. Also, the witness's dog that lived upstairs barked during the whole episode. So the men noticed that the witness was wearing an unusual watch, and one of them touched his arm. The touch felt very cold and clammy. They questioned the witness about his sightings, and one of them appeared to be taking shorthand notes. When they questioned him, they looked into his eyes and seemed to pierce his brain.
What?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like they feel like he's really being interrogated. It says, as they were leaving, they again carefully avoided the microwave. Outside in the yard, they spent about 30 minutes scouring the ground with a Geiger counter. As they rounded the corner of the house, the witness went from the kitchen to the bedroom, which gave him a clearer view of the driveway and the road. Despite the very short period of time it took him to achieve this, the two men were not in sight. Nor was a car leaving, nor car door could be heard slamming.
Huh.
They had vanished. Later, the witness discovered that on the windowsill, only about 6 inches behind where one of the men had been sitting, was a Windex bottle and was partially melted as if the heat had been applied to it. Alongside was a cassette warped in a similar manner. The witness suffered from a severe migraine-type headache after the two men left. His eyes also felt gritty and teary, and his face now appeared sunburned. He also suffered from strange dreams, one that was of lying prone on a table in a round room with a bright light above him, then sensing being touched. Now, 2 days later, while going outside his house, the witness saw the same two men he had seen before in the driveway. Both were dressed in white coveralls this time. One was carrying a Geiger counter, the other a 12 to 16 inch parabolic dish in his hand, pointing to the sky, plus earphones and a microphone that was attached. He appeared to be searching the sky. Says the wires all led into a black box at his waist. At one point, he had what looked like a camera, although not video, aimed at a tree over which the UFO had been originally seen. During the time they were together, neither was seen speaking to each other, nor was any car seen which they might have arrived in. Says in December, a few days after Christmas, a man appeared at the door of the witness again and stated that he had come to see his unusual watch.
What?
Yeah, he said he stated that his name was Mr. Smith and showed some ID. He wore a dark charcoal suit, a white shirt, a black tie. He also wore a black fedora. His feet were very large, they're guessing again, size 13 or 14, like the witness's previous visitors. His shoes were black and shiny with no signs of dirt on them at all. He was about 4 foot 8 inches to 5 foot tall, very thin, very pale skinned, with very long fingers. He also wore black wraparound sunglasses with silver frames. The witness extended his hand out, but was ignored again. Says upon entering the house, the visitor commented upon the carved walking stick in the hallway. He also asked the witness to turn the microwave off before he walked in front of it. Sitting down at the kitchen table, he produced a small silver tape recorder, claiming it could record up to 80 hours or more. Using a pick-like tool from his breast pocket, he examined the witness's watch. He opened a black briefcase, removed some paper, and a silver pencil with a red top, and a pen-like flashlight that emitted a mauve pencil-thin beam, which scanned the interior of the watch with. He took a small digital-type camera, and with it took several pictures of the watch. During the whole time of this visit, he spoke very little, and his speech seemed slurred. Now again, the cats were agitated during this stranger's visit, but he again expressed interest in the watch and the witness. He asked the witness for $500 for it, but he replied that he had to check with his colleagues. The stranger also expressed interest in a computer, saying it had very minimal power. The stranger departed without saying goodbye. The witness went immediately to the window, but could not see any sign of the visitor or any car in the vicinity. He had simply vanished. A plastic hairdryer blower nozzle was found melted, and a ruler in a drawer close to where the visitor had been sitting was bent in a slight S curve. Says again, the witness suffered from severe headache and an eruptive nosebleed. It goes on to say again, in early January of 01, two peculiar strangers again visited the witness to previous UFO encounter, and these two were different from the others. They were at least 6 feet tall, very bony, with head and hands and feet out of proportion with the rest of their body. They wore gray suits that seemed to be oily and black ties and hats, plus, yet again, wraparound sunglasses that they never took off. Said when questioned about the glasses, they remarked that they could see perfectly well. Their ears stood out from their heads, and their skin was pale white, whereas their fingernails were gray in color. They never removed the hats during their visit, and although throughout the whole time, only one of them spoke. And when asked for IDs, they displayed silver cases that contained a photo, an unusual symbol, and their names in very small print. Now here we go again. Upon entering the kitchen, they asked the witness to please unplug the microwave. They also told him to turn off the computer. The two Persian cats were going crazy again and trying to get out of the window that was closed. Each man carried a briefcase with an inverted L-shaped handle. The man that did all the talking asked to see the witness's unusual watch. He then removed from his briefcase four small containers. Each had a different colored top. Opening two, he proceeded to pour the contents over the watch. He told the concerned witness that no harm would come to the watch. He was given $250 for the watch and told that they would give him the rest later. He told them that he was moving soon. To this, they replied, "We know, don't worry, we can find you if we want to." They soon departed without the common courtesies, staring blankly at the witness as he extended his hand. Once again, the witness hurried to the bedroom window, only to find, as before, no sign of either man departing, nor Colt, nor any vehicle, no door slam, no anything. After the visit, the witness felt drained, had a severe headache that lasted for a couple of days, and a rash on his arms, face, and chest.
What the hell is that?
What is that?
Why are the Men in Black stories so bizarre, though?
That?
You know what I'm saying? Like, really, yes. What are they so bizarre?
I can't answer that.
I mean, is the cats going crazy because, just like Alf on Malmac, I mean, they eat cats, isn't that the deal?
Right.
So the Persians go
What's
crazy.
What's the deal with unplugging the microwave, man?
Well, it's perhaps that they are cyborgs. They're not fully a living, physical, breathing entity.
And a microwave messes with them?
Well, if they're part robot, it might.
I don't understand.
I don't know. It's just a theory. How the hell do I know?
I mean, it freaks me out. The whole idea of the Men in Black, that's a very strange thing. That whole encounter of them coming. What's the deal with this watch? Well, they were fascinated with
it. If you had a one-off occurrence, something one time happened to you, I could see, like, you'd always be like, man, I don't know what those guys were doing. That was crazy. To me, though, if they kept coming back, wouldn't you start trying to set up a trap or something?
Yeah.
Like video-wise or a friend-wise?
But that's if
something.
You knew they were going to come back. I mean, you're talking about there's a big gap. It's not like they came back the next day. They didn't say we would come back.
I
want to
know if they ever came back and gave him the other $250 for that watch.
After he moved, they mailed it to him or whatnot. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But they stiff him.
Man, I'm thinking that they stiffed him. That's what I'm thinking, because I'm thinking that's what Men in Black do. They like to stiff him.
Well, you know, our friend Nick Redfern wrote that book, The Real MIB Encounters, and that was a fascinating book. And there are tons of cases in there that just don't make sense.
No. I can't. Look. I understand a UFO. I understand as best you can. I understand the fact you may see something, you may think you see something, you may actually see something. I understand that. I don't understand what is happening where these people just show up, and it's this awkward. It's this strange. I mean, I don't know how I would react to this.
I don't either.
Nobody ever asked. Let me take your picture. Hold on a second. Bink. You know what I mean? I'm going to have to look into some more to see if there's any, like, newer Men in Black, because it's one of those things. You remember the video that came out where they showed, like, two of them come into a hotel?
Yeah, I remember that.
And they left. That was a very strange footage of what those people were, you know? And it's easy to dismiss it nowadays and go, it's just somebody dressing up, playing to be a Man in Black. You know, I mean, there's all these gags and fun reels and all this silly stuff they do on YouTube. It's easy to say that's all it is.
Yeah,
but maybe it's not. You know, maybe it's even easier now to be a Man in Black because people think you're just horsing around. Nobody thinks
always,
twice.
They always seem confused. They always seem to have an odd speech pattern, like they're not real good at carrying a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
They always seem socially awkward, like they don't know that you shake hands or bow or something. You know what I mean? They're always just something quirky about them. Something's off.
You can tell they don't fit in.
So what is that?
I don't know. Just it. They don't fit in. They're not from here.
That is crazy. Well, stick with us, folks. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
All right, folks, we're back. Hope you enjoyed the strange stories, because I enjoyed it. Kyle, that was the whole thing of the raining in the room. That's really interesting. And then, of course, the men in black afraid of a microwave. That's really kind of strange.
It's odd, right? Both stories are odd. I mean, what is going on?
I wish somebody could explain it. You know, it's one of those deals. I hate it because it's like we were always told, when you get started in these subjects, you always end up with more questions than answers. You never get anything answered. It's just like you open another door and another. It's like peeling layers of a never ending onion. It's just you go and you go and you go and you're like, come on already, man, tell me something. But nothing seems to ever pop up.
No, I have no answers for you.
Nothing seems to pop up. Hey, real quick, one of my training partners, a good friend of mine, Mr. Dylan Ashburn, fought this weekend, folks. If y'all ever have, if you have Axis TV, there's an MMA organization called Legacy Fighting, and he fought in the undercard of Legacy Fighting, and he actually won in the second round by a submission move called the Twister, which is made famous. It's a wrestling move, but it was made famous in jiu-jitsu by our friend, Mr. Eddie Bravo. And I've talked to Eddie about it. I got to send Eddie the videos of it and all that. But congrats to Dylan. I think now he moves to 4-1.
Yeah, that's right.
As an amateur, and I believe that he's fixing to turn pro. I think that was the next step is he'll be pro. So maybe before too long, we'll see him on television and the whole thing. And he beats me up often. So I kind of knew what was coming in this whole fight. Yeah, and the guy missed weight. I don't, say nothing else, but the dude missed weight. Dylan was on weight. This guy missed weight, not by a little bit. And for those of you, all of our friends that are into wrestling and MMA and things like that, and Jesse, I know he's into wrestling and all that stuff. There's no bigger disgrace. There's no bigger, I guess you could say, a slap in the face if you miss weight. I mean, it's a very disrespectful thing to do.
Well, absolutely. He wasn't the only one that missed the weight. In fact, Pat Miletich was going off on the episode of the Legacy Fights this week, talking about how disgraceful it is that you miss weight. He's like, there are literally tens of thousands of high school kids that maintain their weight right now in wrestling all across America. You knew about this fight, and you come in and you're 14 pounds too heavy. I mean, what kind of...
There's no excuse.
There's no excuse.
There's none. It's not like you took the fight within a week or two's notice. You know how long it is. My son wrestled from eighth grade to his senior year. And he wrestled at 135, of course, starting his freshman year, had to maintain his weight. He never got to eat Thanksgiving dinner until he was a senior because of surgery in his senior year. But every year, he never made Thanksgiving or Christmas. Thanksgiving, his senior year was the first year he got to eat Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner. That was it. But from eighth grade until his senior year, he never did because he couldn't, because of maintaining the weight that you're agreed upon. And it's just one of those things. It's a pride thing. And it's very disrespectful. So... I don't know the guy. They ended up getting submitted, but he got what was coming to him for being disrespectful. So he didn't get hurt. He just got tapped out. Hurt your pride more than anything else. But folks, thank you so much. I hope the weather gets better. We're having some crazy weather down here. It's kind of up and down. It was 80s one day. Now we're going to be like in the 40s another day. So it's real wacky. Kyle and I are probably both going to get the flu, but it'll be fine. Thank you all so much for your support. Thank you so much for listening. We hope everybody has a wonderful week. For all you elitists, we'll see you again on Thursday. We got a surprise coming up Monday. We got some more ancient history we're going to toss out. So we got some good shows coming up. Thank you all so much. Everybody stay safe. Give somebody a hug. Get ready to plant that garden. I'm going to be discussing that coming up in upcoming episodes. Weather's getting right, folks. Everybody, get your little bucket. Get your little pail. Get your little box. You can grow it in a window. You can grow it in your yard. Everybody, just grow a little something. It's fun. So, everybody, take care. We love you. Be careful.
Peace.